Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
For episode 53 of the Intercooler podcast, we've dreamt up what I think is quite an interesting topic. This is something that I've looked into quite a lot in the past because I'm just sort of fascinated by it. We're talking about motorsport competitors who compete across disciplines, who try their hands at different forms of motorsport. It's something that used to happen just as a matter of course back in the day, and now it happens, I think, much less often. It's a cool topic though, isn't it, Andrew? What do you think? I mean, there used to be a time where the likes of Clark and Moss in a weekend would compete in different stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking up when I knew that this is what you wanted to talk about. I've got a book which details all of Stirling's races, and I mean, on one, in fact, I've got it here. So on the 3rd of April, it's a good book actually. It's called Stirling Moss, All My Races. Anyway, and it reveals that on the 3rd of April 1961, he raced a Cooper in the Lavant Cup and won it. He then raced a Lotus 18 in the Glover Trophy, which is the big Formula One race, and he only came fourth in that for some reason. Oh, the engine wasn't working properly. He then drove a Lotus 19 Monte Carlo in the Sussex Trophy and won that, and ended up driving a DB4 GT Zagato in the big sports car race, the Ford Water Trophy, and came third in that. That was all in one day. That wasn't one weekend. That was a day. With all the qualifying and all the other stuff which goes with it. And to him, that would have just been normal. You know, it would have been a good earner for him because he would have got money for every race that he did. And he'd be sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'm going to be standing around watching other people race. I might as well be out there doing it. And that's just the way that it, and they all used to do it.
How much would you have liked to have been at Goodwood on April the 3rd, 1961?
It would just been great, because it wouldn't have just been him doing it. They would all been doing it. All my heroes would have been there, and they'd all been racing, you know, everything from little saloons to, you know, big Formula One cars and everything else. And I do sort of think I understand why it doesn't happen anymore, but it does seem a shame. I even liked it sort of back in the days, and sadly I'm old enough to remember it, when, you know, they suddenly did things like Pro Car. And they put all the Formula One drivers in, you know, the BMW M1s and support races. And it was just a bit of a demolition derby. And I liked it because it was different and they were all in the same machinery and everything else. But I also just liked the idea of seeing who could do it out of their comfort zone. And just because, as we know from so many examples, just because you happen to be, you know, the bee's knees in a Formula One car doesn't mean you're going to be great even in, you know, a sports car, let alone something like a touring car or a rally car or all sorts of stuff that we're going to go on and talk about, I'm sure. To me, it's really, really interesting. And I guess the question is, who's a better driver? Someone who does really well at everything, or a person who simply excels at one thing? I don't even know if there's an answer to it, but it's an interesting thing to sort of, roll around your mind for a bit.
So if we look back to when Moss was competing in four different races, different types of car at Goodwood in the 60s in a single day. I think what's extraordinary to me is that the skill set just required to drive was highly transferable across different types of vehicle, in a way that it probably isn't anymore. And I love that back then in the 50s and 60s when he was really competing at the highest level, if you could drive, you could pretty much apply that ability to any sort of fast driving, couldn't you? It was a skill set that just transferred across lots of different disciplines. And you're right, there is something lost slightly from motorsport in certainly the top level guys really just staying in their lane. You know, they stick to their category, broadly speaking, and we'll come to all the exceptions to that rule a little bit later on. But there's just something so romantic about these guys in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, really, competing in so many different types of vehicle. It would have just been, as a motorsports enthusiast, it would have been just fascinating watching Clark race in a little touring car and then in a Formula 2 car and a Formula 1 car. And whatever else, I think it's such a treat to the enthusiasts.
So do we think, I mean, we know that there are commercial reasons why this has happened, but do we think there are actually also other reasons, something in the actual driving? I mean, what occurs to me is what has changed from those days to these is grip. You know, we now have cars with slicks and wings and, you know, enormous amounts of downforce, and we know, just as an example, that even if it's just slicks, you know, when Stirling came back briefly in the early 1980s and drove an Audi 80 on slicks with front wheel drive, he couldn't cope with it, apart from when it was raining. And I just wonder whether, if you're the certain sort of driver who excels in a car with, you know, which can develop 4 tons of downforce and 5G and everything else, is that such a different discipline? Does that require such a different skill set from that required to drive something with no downforce and not much grip, like a, you know, like a touring car, or that those skills are no longer transferable in the way that they were back then, when, you know, everything was on, you know, skinny little bicycle tyres, and, you know, the air was something you seek to avoid, not to exploit, as it does today? I can't think really otherwise why it might be.
Yeah, that must be a huge part of it. I suppose there was a time where all racing cars would slide through corners. And so if you could balance a car through a corner, maintain momentum without scrubbing off too much speed, you could do it in any type of vehicle, couldn't you?
Yeah. And you had to slide them because the tyre, I mean, the tyre that they had at the time was, you know, the kind of the ubiquitous Dunlop L section. I mean, that tyre doesn't work without a slip angle. So, you know, it wasn't that they were sliding because they were, you know, over the limit and battling for control and everything. They were just doing what modern drivers do, which is driving their car in a way that gets the most out of the tyres. But back then, you know, the only way you could get those tyres to perform was to slide them. And, you know, that art is completely gone. You know, if you're in a Formula One car and it starts to oversteer, your only thought is to stop it oversteering, isn't it? Or pretty much anything on slicks these days. Whereas back then, that's what you wanted. That's what you did. And maybe it's almost, you know, it's just a completely different skill. It's almost like the difference between, I don't know, driving a car and riding a horse. They are so different. You know, you need skill and you need balance and, you know, an understanding of what's underneath you in both cases. But the actual process is so utterly different that maybe, as I say, the skills aren't transferable. But it's a shame, isn't it?
It is a shame. If you talk to the Franchitti brothers, they talk about, and this probably applies to everyone who's learnt to race, in the modern era, they talk about having been conditioned throughout their careers to, the moment the car steps out, tries to oversteer, what they want to do is get it straight back into line as quickly as possible, because they know they'd be losing speed and momentum otherwise. And it means that it's so alien to them trying to slide a car around, actually trying to provoke it. It just feels bizarre to them. And that must be true for most sort of modern era racing drivers. So you're right. That is a big thing that's changed in the discipline of driving, but from the 50s and 60s, maybe the 70s to today.
But it works the other way. You know, there have been times when I've gone and driven modern cars with lots of grip and lots of downforce, And I'll go out and I'll drive it, and I'll drive it as fast as I feel I can drive it. I'll go back in. And then you look at the data. And they all say the same thing. They say, why are you driving the car like this? You know, you're going up to the corner, you're doing most of your braking in a straight line, and then you're turning in, and then for some reason your throttle trace is doing this, and you're trying to do something, and why are you doing it? You know, you need to brake it all the way into the apex and then accelerate all the way out again. It's not difficult. Because that's the way I've always, because my history, my background has been almost entirely in historic racing. That's the way you need to drive those cars. And, you know, it is such a different thing, regardless of which direction you're going in.
Slick tyres and downforce, really. That's what's changed the driving style, those two things.
Yes.
Get rid. Mostly we've been talking about the sort of transferability of skills between circuit racing disciplines. And you can, I mean, we do sometimes see Formula One drivers stepping into LMP1 cars or Formula E drivers competing in the World Endurance Championship. And you can see that there is a high level of transferability between a single-seater and a prototype, because you've got high downforce, lots of power, and you're on a circuit. What is particularly compelling, I think, is transferability between circuit racing and rallying, particularly sort of loose surface rallying.
Just before we get onto that, I just go back to what you were talking about before? The transfer, you know, you're talking about going from single-seaters to a sports car. You know, if you drive a top, you know, hypercar or GT1 car, or no, well, they're not a sports car, but an LMP car, an LMP1 car. You know, the forces on your body are probably quite close to a Formula One car. I imagine the experience driving the car, okay, you may be inside, no, I imagine, but you know, the way you drive the car is probably quite similar. But of course, what is completely different is you can't be a selfish bastard in a sports car.
Mm.
Yeah? Because there's a bloke waiting in the pits to get in the car, and you can't be a superhero and ruin the car and just hand back a bit of wreckage to him, because he's got to get in after you. And so that requires a completely different mindset, doesn't it? And, you know, and I've had, you know, I've had Formula One drivers say to me that, you know, what you need to succeed in Formula One is to be a completely selfish bastard, because your teammate isn't the person you're trying to help. Your teammate is the person you're trying to beat. And the mindset is completely different, isn't it? And it's a question actually I've really wanted to ask Tom Christensen, and hopefully he'll come on the podcast one day. Because, I mean, 9-time Le Mans winner, you know, did test in Formula One car, but never had a Formula One career. But he was obviously so well cut out for sports car driving. And it's just the sort of person who might be able to shed some light on this. So it's not even enough that the cars are quite similar. I think actually in the mindset of the driver, I think you need to be different people to excel in those sorts of disciplines. Sorry,
interesting
interruption.
Stuff. No, rallying. It's fine. Do you know what? We'll come back to rallying in a moment, because I wasn't really going to talk about this on this podcast, but I might as well. Yesterday, I spoke to Fernando Alonso.
I'm sorry, you kept that near to yourself.
Yeah, it was via video call with a handful of other journalists through Alpine, because they're racing in Bahrain this weekend. Actually, this podcast will go out after the first race of the year. And one of the things I wanted to know from him, because it's been, 3 years, maybe 4 years since he's raced a Formula One car. But since then, he has raced at Indy, he's raced at Le Mans and in the World Endurance Championship. He's won both. He's done the Dakar. And I wanted to know from him if those experiences might make him a better Formula One driver. And he's insistent that it will. And one of the examples that he gave was that at Le Mans in particular, you have to be a team player. You have to consider the bloke who's about to get in the car after you and the two other guys as well. You have to work collaboratively. And he thinks that that can be applied even to Formula One, where you want to work with your teammate to some degree in terms of data and setup.
Do you?
If
you're not as quick as him, which is, I think is probably going to be unlikely in Fernando's case, but, you know, if you're, you know, Albon, I'm sure, you know, last year, I'm sure you would have loved to have seen Max's setup sheets. But if it's the other way around and you're the one with everything to lose and it's your teammate who's not as quick as you, who's the one who's got everything to gain, why would you? You're only going to do it if the boss man comes on the horn and says, you know, show him what you're up to.
You're probably right in practice. I suspect he might say that there's always something to be learned from the other bloke. If it's to do with time management or whatever, there will be something. And it was just interesting to hear Fernando Alonso talk about working collaboratively, because when has he had to do that throughout his career? We know that he and Hamilton had a falling out back in 2007, and their garages went separate ways, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, absolutely, big time. Yeah,
And so
it was really good. Do you remember there was that sort of ad campaign of them at the beginning of the year, and they were absolutely best buddies. Mm. And by the end of it, then they couldn't talk to each other, could they?
And so maybe we now see a different Fernando Alonso, because he understands what it takes to race at Le Mans. He understands what it takes to compete in the Dakar. Do you know what? I will tell this story because it's quite amusing. One of the other journalists asked him. Fernando Alonso has a reputation for being difficult as a teammate. What do you say to that? And Fernando just went, I laugh. And then for 5 seconds, he stared down the barrel of the camera without saying anything. And he just said, it's total nonsense. And he said, this is the third time I've raced for Renault, now Alpine, but it's the third time he's been a part of that team. He said, McLaren had me back. He said, when I got knocked off my bicycle a couple of months ago, my former teammate, Jarno Trulli, offered to go to the supermarket for me to do my shopping. And he says he still speaks to plenty
Jarno
of
with his trolley.
Yeah, he's still drifting
Jarno
around.
Trulli, go on. Yeah.
Drifting around the aisles, no doubt. And and he says he still speaks to Jensen. And he's on good terms with most of his old teammates. So he rejects the idea that he's sort of this pantomime villain who none of his teammates are able to get along with.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, God, I had no idea you were doing that.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite good. I'll stick something up on the Intercooler on Instagram. It'll be up there by the time this podcast goes out. I've probably given away the good bits already, but there we go. I was going to talk about rallying because it seems as though the skills transfer from circuit racing to rallying should be even less than between circuit racing disciplines, because the surfaces are different, the cars are different. You've got pace notes. There's someone else in the car next to you. You know, it's almost a different thing entirely, isn't it? And yet, there was a time where, I mean, we've spoken about Stirling already, but he used to compete in rallying. He came second in the Monty one year.
Yeah.
Another example I want to give, we know Jim Clark was a good rally driver, and Vic Elford as well, a great example. So he won the 1968 Monte Carlo Rally in a 911, and a week later he won the 24 Hours of Daytona in a Porsche 907. Later that year, he won the Targa Florio in a 907. And then later that year, he entered the French Grand Prix in a Cooper and came fourth in his first F1 race.
It's pretty remarkable, really, isn't it?
I think it is.
Vic is an interesting case in point, because you think, oh, there's a rally driver who turned his talents to circuit racing and did really well. In fact, Vic always wanted to be a racing driver, and he only did rallying when he was young and got into rallying because it was just cheaper than circuit racing, and you could go and rally almost anything, almost anywhere. And then obviously once he started driving for Porsche and rallying, you know, they were competing on both in rallying and sports cars, then he was able to make the transition. But if we look at the, I'm sure you'll have this in front of you, incidences of rally drivers doing circuit racing and vice versa. What can we learn from that about whether rally drivers are better racing drivers or racing drivers are better rally drivers?
Okay, Sebastian Loeb is a good example. For my money, the greatest rally driver ever. And he perhaps wasn't necessarily the first. I know our friend Marino Franchitti will be listening to this, and if I dare say that Loeb was first to apply a circuit racing driving style to rallying, he'll send me a text message saying, nope, that was Richard Burns. And who knows, maybe there's someone before him who did it. So hello, Marino. But anyway, Loeb, he did apply a circuit racing style to rallying, and he won 9 world championships because of it. And he's done a fair amount of racing. In 2006, he competed at Le Mans with Pescarolo and came second, which is, that's no mean feat, is it?
Yeah, that is no mean feat at all.
However, he raced in the World Touring Cars with Citroën for a couple of years. And he won a handful of races, but never the title. And so here's this, the greatest rally driver ever, for me, for my money, with what's recognised as a neat, accurate, precise driving style. And he wasn't able to apply it to circuit racing to a world championship winning standard.
No.
I mean, that is a very, very high level. But
yeah, but it's not just a world championship winning standard. It's a multiple. It's a back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back world championship. It's where you are at a level in your preferred discipline where you are so much better than anybody else. You know, pretty much, if you don't fall off, you know, the best anybody else is gonna be able to do is come second. And so the gap between that level and, you know, winning the odd race in a touring car is so enormous, isn't it? Even though if you were, you know, someone who hadn't got that history and you won the odd race as a touring car, people will think you're a pretty good touring car driver. But actually, it just goes to show that the gap between the preferred discipline and whatever it is that you choose to then go on and do is, I mean, it is almost unbridgeable, isn't it?
Mm. These days, yeah. And there's another example with Loeb. So he competed in World Rallycross for a couple of years. He won two rounds. So similar to his World Touring Car Championship, won a couple of rounds, but never won the title, never finished higher than fourth in the championship standings in World Rallycross. And you'd think that the transferability between rallying and rallycross would be higher.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Than rallying and touring cars. And yet he wasn't able to compete at a championship winning standard again. Which suggests to me that every discipline has become more highly specified, and only by being a specialist in that discipline can you actually win championships these days. And I think it's probably because the cars become more sophisticated, the driving style necessary becomes more refined, more honed, more specific, so that transferring from one to another is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, yeah. But it does happen, doesn't it? I mean, can we talk about
sometimes
Nico Hülkenberg for a second?
Yeah, we can. So he was a Force India driver in 2015. Did Le Mans once with Porsche and won the thing.
I don't think he'd ever done a sports car race before, did he?
Had no.
He? I don't think he had any experience in sports cars at all.
No.
And okay, fine. Okay, he was obviously driving with Nick Tandy. I can't remember who the third driver was.
Good question. Earl Bamber?
But he obviously... It was. Well done. Well done. Yes, no, you're absolutely right. It was Earl Bamber. Good on you. Well done. And so obviously, you know, those guys are complete sports car legends. And so he had a lot of help from them. So it wasn't all just him. But nevertheless, I mean, he was as good as them. I mean, he wasn't exactly a passenger in that car, was he? He was right up there with the best of them. And so he somehow was able to do it. I mean, the sadness to me, just thinking about what you were talking about these things becoming so specialist, is that, you know, you imagine you are someone like Lewis. Now, I think it is likely that Lewis will this year win more world championships than anybody in the history of the sport. And the last possible suggestion that he is anything other than, you know, one of the very, very greatest. I'm not going to call him the greatest of all time because we've had this conversation before about not being able to compare across either. But definitely with as good a claim to being the greatest of all time as anybody else out there. And, you know, and I think at the end of that, given that there's going to be a big reg change next year and who knows what might happen, and given that we know that he did think long and hard about racing in Formula One even this year, is he going to be thinking, oh, I'm going to go off and do sports cars, or I'm going to go off and do Indy cars, or is he going to think, I'm just going to get my ass kicked because I'm a Formula One specialist? And we know that all those people who have those sorts of experiences, well, not all of them, because as you say, Fernando was able to do very well in sports cars, but the potential of just being not as good as you were and somehow your legacy, your reputation suffering as a result, when you, let's face it, you don't need the money, why are you going to do it? You're just going to go, well, see you guys, never get in a racing car again, unless you're one of those guys, and they still do exist, who don't, you know, people who race to race, not to win. And they race because they love racing, and they'll race until they're until literally no one will give them the racing car anymore because it defines them. And but I don't think that someone like Lewis is going to be like that at all. He's going to have his music. He will have his fashion brand. He'll go and do all. There's so many other things he's going to go and do. He'll clearly be a campaigner for the issues that are important to him. So why is he going to go and do Indy cars and come fifth?
Mm. If you listen to him talk about other forms of motorsport, I think he's more drawn to two wheels than other four-wheeled vehicles. He'd get whooped, wouldn't he, at a world championship standard.
He would be at 36, 37 in MotoGP, having never done anything like that before. Yeah, I absolutely don't believe that even Lewis would be able to get on top of that. It's just too, even for a card-carrying superhero like him, it's just too much of an ask, isn't it?
Back to Fernando Alonso. So another thing I asked him was, you've got your F1 titles. We know you're one of the greats. You've gone well at Indy. You've won Le Mans, won the World Endurance Championship. Why is it that you've not been able to leave Formula One alone? And he said it was because this time last year, the biggest challenge available to him was to return to Formula One. He said he could have done Indy, but that's one race. He could have done Dakar, but that's one. And the biggest challenge presented to him on the table in front of him was to come back to Formula One. And he just seems like one of those guys who wants to test himself in a car to the highest standard possible. And that, for now, happens to be Formula One.
Yeah, but I think he's also a bloke who just loves racing. I think he is a... I think that Lewis is a natural born... I mean, he's clearly a natural born racing driver, but Lewis is a natural born winner. I think Lewis is motivated by the winning. I think that's what Lewis really, really wants to do. I'm sure Alonso does too. But I think more than that, I think Fernando wants to race.
Yeah, I said, is this about getting that third title that you really think you deserve? And he said, it's not that. It's just about the challenge.
It must be, because he must know, with the best will in the world, I don't think that there is any credible commentator who would say that, with the way things are in Formula One at the moment, that Fernando stands an outside chance of being a Formula One champion, certainly not this year. There are freak occurrences, he might win the odd race. I don't think so. So he's in it, as you say, for the challenge. He's in it to be a Formula One driver, to prove to himself and to any of the other people that he's still got it, that he can still do it, and because he just feels the need to push himself. And that is the motivation. I absolutely believe he's not sitting there thinking, oh, I could be world champion.
Mm, it does seem that's the case, yeah. okay, so I want to mention a couple of others who have competed across disciplines. I should just briefly mention Sebastian Buemi, because he's... Formula E champion, and he's competed in the WEC a lot and won Le Mans. It was in 2018-19, that the WEC season, the Formula E season, that he finished second in the championship there. He won the WEC title and he won Le Mans. That was with Nissan and Toyota. So, that's quite impressive, isn't it? Winning Le Mans, winning the WEC, and finishing second in the Formula E standings all in the same season. That's quite impressive.
Good. But he never quite managed it in Formula One, did he?
Never quite managed it in Formula One, yeah. I think he had a good go in that in the Toro Rosso, didn't he? And he was ultimately dropped.
How good, and this is because I don't know anything about rallying, but you do, how good was Kubica in a rally car?
I think there's a feeling that he could have competed at the highest level in a rally car.
Had he not had the accident?
Yeah, to an extent that Kimi Raikkonen probably couldn't have done. I'd have to talk to a few people about this, actually, to really understand that. But I think there is a feeling that he could have made the grade in a rally car. But his whole story, it gives us another sort of understanding of why Formula One teams, Le Mans teams, don't like their drivers competing, particularly in rallying. Kubica,
absolutely.
Depending on how his F1 career had turned out, if he'd been in the right car at the right time, he certainly had the ability to win multiple races and a championship or two. Certainly.
Yes, he did. Yeah, if he'd had the right breaks, I think, you know, he would have. I mean, let's put it this way. I think we could all name people who have won championships who are not as good as Kubica was at his peak.
Mm. There's no question about it, really. And it was that crash and that horrible arm injury that he sustained that put paid to all of that. So, I mean, it's no surprise that we don't see top-line racing drivers competing in rallying very often because the risks are too great. Although, I mean, Kimi did it back in, what was it, 2010, 2011. He did two not quite full seasons in the WRC. It was when... So he, by that point, had won his title with Ferrari. He raced with them for a couple of seasons. And then they paid him a huge sum of money to make way for Fernando, didn't they? And so he competed in the WRC for a couple of years. And this was when I was following rallying, world rallying, really quite closely. And just looking at my notes now, he never finished higher than fifth in a rally. He did almost two full seasons, not quite, and no podium. I do remember, though, that he set a fastest stage time on Rally Germany one year on a super special stage, a spectator stage, so a shorter one, you know, around bits of a car park and, you know, around some city streets. Tarmac, yeah, and it's not a long stage where, with lots of unsighted corners. The point being, his pace notes...
It was most circuit-like.
Most circuit-like, and pace notes were less of a factor on that sort of stage. So, with that out of the equation, he was able to operate a World Rally car as quickly as anybody else. In terms of sitting there, turning the wheel, doing the pedals, he could do that as quickly as anybody else. But when you introduce a very long stage, and crucially, the importance of pace notes, he wasn't able to compete with the top guys because trusting your co-driver, driving to pace notes, is a skill that you learn over many, many years. And it's not something you can fake. You know, you can't force that in a couple of years. It really takes a long time to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So are we going to have a stab at who we think the most versatile driver of all time was?
Yeah, we could do that. It's not going to be... Well, I suggest it's not going to be a recent guy, is it?
No, can't be. It can't be. I mean, I think the most versatile drivers have come from America.
That's interesting.
Because of the way that they brought... I mean, yeah, okay, so, you know, guys like... two in particular, Dan Gurney, Mario Andretti. But there are lots and lots of examples out there. People who were brought up, and you know, there's dirt track racing, there's stock car racing, and then there's NASCAR, and there's Trans Am, and there's IndyCar, and there's all that. And then they go off and they do all the other stuff as well. So, you know, I mean, Mario's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, yeah, and also the other thing is, which I think is another form of versatility, which is longevity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mario's first and last appearances at Le Mans were 34 years apart. His first one was 1966, his last one was in 2000.
Just imagine the technology change in that time.
Exactly, he was in a GT40 in 1966. And I can't remember what he was in 2000. It would have been he certainly raced, you know, Group C cars at Le Mans. You know, he came in 1995. You know, he came second overall. This is great disaster because he wanted to be, you know, the next person after Graham Hill to win the Holy Trinity. So, you know, the F1 World Championship, the Indy 500 at Le Mans. And obviously he did the Indy 500, won that in 1969, won the F1 World Championship in 1978. Never won Le Mans. Came second in 1995. You know, over 30 years after his Le Mans debut in a Courage, won his class, and he was only beaten by the McLarens because they were running in a GT category with, you know, completely different set of regs, and I think that they'd slowed the prototype so much by just giving them, you know, thimble-sized fuel tanks that no prototype could ever realistically win the race, and he still came second. He did the Indy 500 29 times. I mean, it's extraordinary. And yet, his early history is all in stock car racing. And yet, he could go and drive a Slicks and Wings ground effect Lotus 79, you know, the first car with proper ground effect. So, you talk to people who were in that era. You talk to people like Jackie Ickx and Derek Bell, who in sports cars came from sports cars without ground effects to sports cars with ground, and just what a complete change of mindset you needed just to be able to get your head around what those cars could do. And yet Mario could just get into, you know, the first Formula One car, probably, you know, the first Formula One car which would pull, you know, 4+G through a corner. And he would just go and be quicker than him. And when his teammate was Ronnie Peterson, who was no bloody slouch. So, you know, I think Mario would get my vote for everything, for the sheer range of stuff that he competed in, and the time in which he did it. I just don't. And also, obviously, the success that he had. You know, he won Sebring 12 hours 3 times. He won the Daytona 24 hours. I mean, basically, the only thing he didn't, he's like Sterling, the only thing he didn't win was Le Mans. Except he did win the World Championship, the F1 World Championship, which not even Sterling managed to do. So, yeah.
Mm. Unbelievable. Do you know what? The longevity thing is such an interesting point. Something we should talk about a little bit. Yeah, and we see it in all forms of, in plenty of forms of motorsport. I'm thinking Arri Vatanen. He won the WRC title in 1981 in an Escort, Mark II Escort, RS1800. Rear drive, naturally aspirated engine up front, manual box. And he continued competing as the regulations changed and changed and changed. So through the Group B era, and he won rallies, certainly. Through the Group A era, and he won. And I'd have to look this up, but he might even have carried on competing into the WRC era in the late 90s, when you've got active diffs, turbochargers, maybe even paddle shift gearboxes by that point, perhaps. And real aero as well by that point. And so just think about how the machinery beneath him changed his long career. That's something that we should celebrate a bit more, isn't it? These people with real longevity who are able to adapt to new regulations and new types of technology.
And of course, some can't. I mean, you know, an example I can think of is Graham Hill, who started racing in Formula One in the late 1950s and was still doing it in the mid 1970s. I mean, that's, you know, amazing even that he survived that long in that sport at that particular time. But the truth is that by the mid-1970s, he just couldn't face not racing. But he was, you know, a man who won the Monaco Grand Prix 5 times, 2 Formula One world championships. By the end of it was, you know, he just wasn't fast anymore, not by the standards that were required at that time. But guys like Mario, and I'm sure Vatanen, were still right up there and competitive. Up until they left the sport, because I guess to them, to be anything else would have just, you know, would have taken the fun out of it. You just don't want to be going around there making up the numbers.
Mm. Okay, at the start you posed a really interesting theoretical. You said, so who is the best driver? Is it the one who's got 7 Formula One titles, Lewis, Michael? Or is it the one who's competed in multiple different categories over a long period of time and been at the sharp end throughout? It's an interesting one, isn't it?
Which way are you going? There's no wrong answer here.
There's no wrong answer. Okay, so who's the better athlete? Someone who wins the decathlon?
Oh, good question.
And is able to compete in various different disciplines? Or is it Usain Bolt, who just monstered the sprinting discipline, over, actually, quite a broad period of time? It's inevitable that we celebrate one more than the other, isn't it? Because they grab the
headlines.
We
certainly celebrate the Bolts and the Lewises more than we do the... I'm just trying to think of a famous decathlete. Daley Thompson, that's how old I am. He's the only British decathlete I can remember. And the... I guess the Mario Andretti's. Yeah. Yeah, the people who stay focused and do the most in one very, very narrowly defined discipline are the ones that... get remembered and revered. But that doesn't mean you and I have to think that way.
No, it's true. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. There's definitely something in people who are adaptable and who are prepared to put their reputations on the line and try lots of different things.
Okay, who do you admire more?
Despite everything I've just said, for some reason, I admire the specialist. The record-breaking specialist a bit more. And I don't actually know why that is, because even thinking about it now, it doesn't make a great deal of sense to me, but that's just the way I feel.
Wow. Okay. So we disagree. There you go. Everybody who says that you and I always spend our time on this podcast agreeing with each other, I'm not with you, I'm afraid. I will always admire a Mario or a Sterling more than I will. But that might also say because these people were doing those sorts of things, you know, at a time when I found motor racing, frankly, more interesting than I do now. You know, I really, really admire guys like Lewis who can be so good, particularly, you know, let's not forget how long Lewis has been at the top for. You know, this is his 15th season of Formula One, and he bloody nearly won the first one. Yeah. And he's still absolutely, 15 years Lewis has been, you know, the man to beat out there. And I completely admire that. So he's certainly got the longevity, particularly as far as I can see. He's certainly not getting any worse, and he might still be getting better. But to me, the person, because I tell you what it is, to me, the person who can be quick in, you know, a touring car, a F2 car, an F1 car, a sports car, an Indy car, whatever, to me, is a person who just loves racing for the sake of racing, just loves racing anything. I will get into anything, and I will race it because that's what I love doing. And you tend to be better at the things that you enjoy doing. That argument may not stand up to most scrutiny, but in my head, that's kind of the way that I see it. Whereas if you're someone who is just focused on one thing, I'm just thinking you don't love the racing, you love the winning. And that's what motivates you. And I'm always and always will be more interested in people who love to race than people who love to win.
Fair enough. There we go. Mark it on your calendars. We disagreed on something. There we go. It's a great topic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
I enjoyed talking about that. Okay, well, we'll leave it there. But this episode goes out after this weekend's, the weekend's Bahrain Grand Prix. So we just have to make our predictions here so that everyone can hear how terribly wrong we got it. I'm going with Perez for the win.
Sorry, why did I laugh? That's not you know, inconceivable by any means. I mean, you're completely wrong, obviously. It'll be Lewis.
Okay. Good stuff. All right. Well,
Okay. Just on the Perez front, at the end of the season, Max or Perez?
Max.
Max. All day long.
Will Perez do better than Albon did?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. Seb or Lance?
Seb, but not by as much as you think, for three reasons. I had this conversation with my brother yesterday. I'll now forget what the reasons are. Firstly, Seb is not as... I think when Seb was winning all his titles with Red Bull, I think the car was very good indeed. Secondly, I think that Lance is better than people think he is. And thirdly, I've forgotten. I came up with a really plausible third reason why they're going to be closer to each other, and not just because it's Lance's dad's team and therefore the team will be better. I don't know, there is a third reason, but no, so I think Sebastian will definitely do better than Lance, but not by as much as people think, for three reasons, only two of which I can remember.
I think Lance will outscore him because Seb hasn't yet beaten a younger teammate.
It's true. Okay, well, watch this space.
There we go. We'll see how wrong we get it a little bit later on. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening or for watching. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, subscribe to our YouTube channel. And, well, as you know, we've got loads more coming over the next few weeks. Stay tuned, and we'll talk to you
again. We keep on talking
next week
about it, but very, very, very shortly, we will actually start doing it, won't we?
We will. Yeah, and we'll see you again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.